second of five conversations about changes in the way the war question looks. And there is some sequence from one to the next. To some extent, we depend on the concepts that were laid out the last time, so it will help to restate the four basic logical possibilities for how one may reason or choose not to reason about the morality of war. We identified as realism, in quotes, the claim that you don't really think it is not a subject for moral discernment. Governments just do what they have to do. Rulers just do what is in their interest, and people just do what they're told. And that is not only a cynical position, that is a position held with intellectual integrity by some very intelligent people, saying that that is just the way it is, and therefore it's inappropriate to bring moral language to bear on the question. Second, we saw the category of the holy, that is war that is an instrument of a divine will, if you have the conception of a Yahweh or an Allah who actually sends people off to battle. The goals are revealed. You don't consider probable success or effectiveness because the action itself is worthy and heroic, and obviously people on the other side have no rights because they're God's enemies. The other end of the scale, in a certain sense, is obviously what we call pacifism. Ink in these felts is not always of the same strength, which is the conviction that on basic moral grounds it's never right to take the lives of one's fellow human beings on purpose in an institutional way, which is what we call war, a position which has been held by many individuals, but obviously which people who hold that position cannot impose on other people because of their own not using coercion as a way to achieve the implementation of their purposes. And then the pattern that developed in organized Christian thought in the early Middle Ages that we'll be giving the most attention to for this time, but already talked about a little the last time, is what in code language is called just war. More precisely, it would be called justifiable war. It's not held that that kind of an activity is a beautiful thing or a righteous thing, but simply that it is justifiable. It's evil, but it's a lesser evil under certain circumstances. And to know what those circumstances are, you have to look at the case in detail, and you have to ask precise questions about the cause for which it is fought, the attitude with which it is fought, the authority of the organization that fights it, and the means that you use. Now, what we're to look at especially today as the major subject matter of change over the centuries until modern times, I've entitled The Rise and Decline of the Just War Concept. It's not rise and decline the way the edge of a mountain goes on a Holden sweatshirt, that it first goes up and then it goes down. It's rather watching through the centuries that there have been both elements of strengthening and elements of weakening. It is the purpose of the just war mode of thought is to restrain violence. It says there will be violence carried on by states, and that's bad. We want to have as little as possible. So we will permit it under certain circumstances and not permit it under other circumstances. So when we speak of the rise of that tradition, it will be the times when moral thinkers, political figures, increasingly define those criteria that have to be met for a war to be justified, explain why those criteria are necessary, that is, why is it that you don't kill innocent people, why is it that a war can only be fought by legitimate authority, making sense out of that system, and then implementing the system by saying this particular mode of combat, this particular cause, cannot justify military activity, and explain why that is. We'll say that the tradition is getting stronger when those resources for restraining war are getting stronger. And I'll look at some of that first. And we'll say that it's declining when things are happening which make it harder to restrain war. Some of those rising factors come at different periods through the time from the Middle Ages to modern times, and the decline as well. So we'll be looking at factors pushing in both directions, but there's never one particular line where we can say, well, right now the theory was working very well, and now it has been set aside for a particular time. In the Middle Ages, it was the concern of bishops and such theologians as we know about to restrain war by using all of the resources they could think about. I mentioned this a little the last time as to the actual intellectual origins. Where did the ideas come from? Well, the first church fathers who talked about justifiable war got it from the Roman political philosophers. The Bishop Ambrose got it from the Roman political philosopher Cicero, who had theories about what people ought to do in office. So you have a notion of what is appropriate for a particular kind of official to do. He has a right to use violence for some purposes and not for other purposes. Then in the Middle Ages, there was more attention to a ritual vision of life. That is, people understood life to be dealing with what you can handle in ceremonies and the special ceremonies of the rituals of the church. In order to have the right to be a priest, you must never have shed blood. In order to have the right to receive communion, you must never have shed blood unjustly. So the procedures of penance and absolution called into being manuals where a priest would deal with a person preparing for communion and ask whether you have shed blood. Well, if you had, was it in a just war or an unjust war? So the rules developed out of what we call canon law, that is the rule for the management of the rituals of the church, in which there was this deep symbolic sense that blood is sacred and shedding blood offends God and must be somehow made right before you can be restored to the sacramental communion of the church. At the same time that rules were being made about what is justifiable in war, there was also a strong political involvement of the bishops of the Middle Ages. That is, the bishops in the Middle Ages were about the only forces of law and order that there were. When many small political forces were fighting each other, the bishop tended to be responsible for more territory and to have some interest in the peace of his territory. And there were ways in which a bishop, as the pastor of his province, could work for peace, apart from the just war tradition, but reinforcing it. There was what they called the truce of God, in which a bishop or a council would simply say, no fighting during Lent, no fighting on certain holy days. And people would respect that, because the church had that kind of authority at that time, moral authority disposing of the life of the sacraments. And if the bishop says you can't fight during Lent, and the people on the other side are under the same bishop, you won't lose anything by not fighting during Lent. It comes out even. You just do your rest and recreation during that period. So people could fight fair and have less war. So there was a general pacifying impact of the pastoral vision of the church, without saying that the war is always wrong, restraining it. Similarly, there was what they called the peace of God, which was spatial rather than temporal. Certain people were set aside. You shouldn't draw into war religious, that is, monks and nuns, or pilgrims going off to the Holy Land. You must just leave them out of your hostilities. Or the peace of God also touched on certain places. You must never fight in church buildings and cemeteries and monastery land. So those were sanctuary. So the effort to restrain war in the medieval culture included holy spaces set apart, holy times set apart, holy people set apart, and there can't be any war there. Bishops also acted actually politically to mediate. Bishops were themselves often princes with some land of their own and were involved in the struggles of that kind. And when there was a hassle between two royal houses, often a bishop would be able to mediate or moderate, to arbitrate the conflict so that it wouldn't have to be fought out to the bitter end. And in principle, that can still happen. If the country involved is Catholic enough to believe in the authority of that particular bishop. You may not have noticed, but it was in the papers that just a few years ago, the Pope mediated a conflict between Argentina and Chile about the ownership of a few islands way down at the other end of South America. Both countries were Catholic.
each of them recognized it wasn't really worth a war. Each of them had their pride involved, so they couldn't just give in. So they called on the Pope, and the Pope very carefully worked out a settlement that would save everybody's face, and they all accepted it, so now there's peace between Argentina and Chile. Well, the bishops did that all the time in the Middle Ages. It's a kind of a throwback to medieval period when it can work in our century. The next kind of thing that we see happening is a critical response to new weapons. The technology for war, of course, started becoming more organized as soon as there were people to pay for it and ingenious people to think up new weapons. So in the 12th century, they invented the crossbow, which would make it possible to put much more power behind a projectile so that the ability to destroy life would reach farther than the strength of the human muscle that you used to have to count on before. And the catapult, that is an instrument for throwing a stone at the wall of a besieged city, these two escalations of the power of destruction in the 12th century were specifically condemned by councils of the church. That is, the bishops would get together and say, these weapons must never be used. They didn't have any clear mode of enforcement, but of course, if you were a pious Catholic knight, you would accept those limits, and of course, you'd expect the enemy to fight fair, too. The restrictions were supposed to apply on both sides. So that's the beginning of the notion that you can have war and regulate it. You can't stop it, but you won't let it go with a blank check. You will restrain it by having particular kinds of regulations about how it'll be carried out. The next upgrading of seriousness in trying to use the just war notion we see in the Catholic theologians in Spain at the time of the colonization or the seizure of South America. In the eyes of Christopher Columbus himself and in the eyes of Ferdinand and Isabella, the taking of South America was really a kind of crusade, that it was a holy cause. The Indians or the natives, whoever they were, it was of course an act of colonialism to call them Indians because they weren't in India. Europeans decided to call them Indians, but it was a decision of Europeans that those people didn't really have human rights. Their land is there for the taking. A few Catholic theologians, a man named Francisco de Vitoria in the 16th century and Suarez in the 17th, developed careful theological implications out of the just war tradition, which they could obviously claim by now is the official Catholic tradition, saying that the humans in the New World are human beings like us. They have souls like us, which for a while Europeans didn't want to believe. They have rights like us. We maybe can claim that it's all right for us to be there as merchants or as missionaries. And if the local people interfere with the freedom of movement of merchants and missionaries, we may perhaps defend their freedom of movement, but we have no right to kill those people, no right to make war against them, no right to subjugate them and make slaves of them. Those theologians weren't listened to, but they were there. That is, it shows that the tradition intellectually is alive and the people who want to apply it honestly can do so. And they did so to condemn the way the Portuguese and the Spanish were exploiting the Western Hemisphere. At about that same time, there comes along what we call the Renaissance. That is a blossoming of literate culture and the arts, represented probably most strongly, at least most famously, by the Dutchman Erasmus, who projected the vision of war as simply unworthy of the dignity of mankind as we now understand what it means to be human. Humanism is the name we give in culture to the rising respect for culture, intelligence, the arts, everything that is gradually building up as peaceful society rises out of the Middle Ages with commerce and then the coming of print and a kind of sense that all of Europe, all of Christendom is one unity. Erasmus had pen pals all the way to Salamanca, all the way to Moscow, and all the way to Edinburgh, and all this whole wide world of people writing to each other as friends and reading each other's poetry, there was a vision of a Christendom at peace. And in the face of that unity of the human race that is more visible than had been the case two centuries before, For Erasmus, war was simply unworthy of an intelligent being like what the human race is called to be. You ought to be able to solve your problems differently. He made physiological arguments, saying that compared to animals that are born with tusks and claws and sharp teeth, humans are born defenseless and dependent on one another for their survival, an argument from the nature of things. War is destructive and stupid, which is what some of us heard the preacher say Sunday evening. The standard is not that Jesus says don't kill your enemies. The standard is simply that it's unworthy of the dignity of the human race and of culture, as we intelligent humanists in the Renaissance are unfolding it, that people should try to solve their problems by destroying each other. So the Renaissance vision of humanistic unity. The next phase of development of the just war tradition that becomes important is that the lawyers begin to take hold of it. The Dutch diplomat Hugo de Groot, or Grotius, who died in 1645, was active, therefore, as a diplomat in the time of the Thirty Years' War, the last great spasm of war dividing Europe about religion. And this was the age of the beginning of diplomacy as a profession, the idea that there can be a core of people whose business it is to communicate between nations on matters of national interest, and they need guidelines. So the Laws of War and Peace, that's the name of the book that Grotius wrote, and other people started writing books like that, so that lawyers and diplomats could use them as a basis for negotiation, for prosecuting pirates, for adjudicating problems out in the colonies. This is the age, of course, when the major European nations are building colonies, and nobody polices the seas. There is no law on the seas, so you can only have law on the seas if the diplomats get together and decide what we're going to do with piracy and blockades and matters like that. So there develops international law as a profession, as a body of texts, with the notion that all the nations must live on a world scale as if there were a world law, even though there is no world government. That begins with the name of Grotius and is especially effective in the realms of sea trade and the building of empires. So we've come up to about 1700, seeing increments of seriousness in the minds of people who believe that you can restrain war and explain how. And they've created a large body of cultural resources if you want to make use of those resources. And since that's half of the story, that's the rising part. And maybe we should stop for a couple minutes just if there are any questions of fact or clarification before I go to the other side of the story. Now, when people talk about the just war tradition, they mean all of those things. They mean the humanism of Erasmus, with the idea that the total race ought to be able to get along intelligently because we are rational creatures, and the diplomacy represented by Grotius, that statesmen have ways of solving their problems by using the rules and arbitration and negotiation, and behind that, the body of concerns by churchmen and theologians that the sacredness of life and the peaceableness of the community is something that church as a whole and the bishops as shepherds have a stake in. But now we look at the other side of the story, which is the same time period, but other things happening, which worked against the seriousness or the effectiveness of the restraints that we've just been talking about. And the place to begin would be probably back in the Middle Ages where I began before with the technology, that is, somebody starts thinking up crossbows and catapults and other modes of destruction that get more effective. The bishops can say they're illegitimate, but you still know how to do them from now on, and somebody's probably going to start using them. So technology as an agent of change is important from way back when, but we'll look at it especially a little later in the story. But the first set of changes come with the Protestant Reformation and other things going on at the time of the Protestant Reformation, which are not all the work of the reformers, but some of them are. And since North American Protestantism pretty largely goes back to that Reformation in its self-understanding, and particularly Lutherans do, it's appropriate to be aware, more than most people are, that the century of the Reformation led to a significant weakening of the ability of the just war system to exercise restraint. Some of this is in my little booklet in the bookstore published by Augsburg Press. surveying some of the same things we're talking about here in the middle section. One thing that the Reformation does is to downgrade the moral authority of bishops and theologians over against governments. The Roman Catholic bishops and theologians had their mandate from above, from the Pope, and from the theological tradition that a theologian was qualified to interpret. And they could, they didn't often, but they could criticize their prince. They had the moral authority to do it, and they had the intellectual wherewithal to criticize their prince. But the Protestant Reformation, speaking institutionally, is the product of the princes. Luther had to have a prince to protect him from the bishops and the Holy Roman Empire. Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich had to have the local city council. Martin Bucer in Strasbourg had to have the local city council to protect him from the Catholic powers. William of Orange in the Netherlands protected the Reformed tradition from the Catholic powers. So the churches, in the institutional sense, that is, the people in positions of bishops and theologians, were the employees of the political authorities. They're much less likely then to criticize the political authorities and telling they're fighting an unjust war because it's your boss. And they were, their Reformation was saved by the princes. And they could, in principle, talk back to their princes, but they were less likely to do it than in the previous period when the authority of a theologian or of a bishop was not dependent on the backing of his local prince. Sometimes Ulrich Zwingli, the father of the Reformed tradition, criticized his local government for not being belligerent enough because he really wanted a crusade. He wanted a war for the Reformation. In fact, he did provoke a battle in which he lost his life. Another thing that the Reformation did, not only intentionally, but in an accessory way, was to foster the development of independent nations as communities, geographical, ethnic, and political communities, more and more claiming sovereignty, that is, independent of neighboring communities. The notion of national autonomy, so that a given royal house or a given ethnic nation will claim that those other people are not part of us anymore. The just war tradition had arisen in the age of Christendom, that is, when everybody was thought to be Christian. The French are baptized Catholic Christians, and the Bavarians are baptized Catholic Christians, and the Belgians and the Spanish and the Italians, so they shouldn't fight each other, or if they do fight each other, they should be under the same just war restrictions because they're part of the same cultural family. That sense of Christendom as a cultural family is broken apart now by the Reformation and by other forces which create independent nations, so that there is less of the a priori expectation that the people on the other side of any conflict are also fellow Christians, fellow humans, people we ought to consider as having rights even when we have some reason to be their adversaries in a political struggle. Another kind of thing that Protestantism did relates back to the religious mood of medieval culture. I talked about sacred times and sacred places and religious people who belonged out of war, and that was very understandable in the medieval sense of ritual religion, but the Reformation sweeps that all away in favor of ordinary human values. We don't want nuns and priests to be different anymore. There are no holy places anymore. All of God's earth has the same status. So the place where there were exceptions to the reign of war have been swept away. Another change is on the verbal level, but it's more than verbal. The just war tradition now is in the creeds. The medieval Catholics knew, if they had an education, that all respectable theologians hold to this just war tradition. But it had never been promulgated by a pope or by an ecumenical council as infallible or binding doctrine. You could be a pacifist and not be a heretic. St. Francis was a pacifist and not a heretic. There were pacifists who were not heretics. It's a minority position. You're outvoted by the tradition, but it's not a heresy. It has never been condemned. To this day, pacifism has never been condemned by the Roman Catholic Church. But it was condemned in the formation of the official Protestant churches, in the Augsburg Confession. It's in Article 16. It's also in the 39 Articles of the Church of England and in the Westminster Confession of the Reformed Tradition. The just war position is now the true theological position, and those who hold otherwise are heretical. So that means that what initially was a kind of regretful concession to the fact that there's always going to be war and we try to restrain it, now the Protestant creeds say war can be right. It's a less questioning, a less restrained kind of affirmation. Of course, the reason that it got written into those confessions is that in the 16th century there were also some new beginnings of pacifist thinking, and the reformers clearly wanted to take their distance from that. One more thing that the Reformation does is that now religion itself can be a subject for Christians to fight each other about. Previously, Christians could fight Muslims in holy wars about Palestine. But now you can have a fight between cousins on two sides of the Rhine as to whether their turf is supposed to be under a Catholic prince or under a Lutheran prince. So there is a heightening of the stakes and the readiness to dehumanize your near neighbor, even your cousin just on the other side of the Rhine or the Moselle or the Eder. And religion now can be something that it's proper to have governments fighting each other about. Whereas in the standard understanding of the just war, or in the clear understanding that Victoria was working out now to talk about South America, it is not proper to fight wars against people to impose true religion on them, because true religion cannot be imposed by force. And this possibility of war for religion goes in the 16th century, only hypothetically, but seriously, to the point of revolution. That is, if your ruler is against the true faith, against the preaching of the gospel, it would be appropriate that your ruler be assassinated. Now, that didn't actually happen in the 16th century, but there were Huguenots in France after the Bartholomew of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Night, 1573, 10,000 Calvinists were killed in France. There were Calvinist theologians after that who said it would be appropriate to assassinate the King of France. And there were Jesuits, after the Jesuits had been kicked out of England, who wrote pamphlets saying it would be appropriate for the Queen of England to be assassinated. It didn't really happen, but the theory is there, the literature is there. The case is being made that for the sake of our right to exercise our religion, it would be appropriate that we use the means of military conflict to take over the civil order in order to get one that will foster our religion instead of repressing it. That's all the Reformation century, although some of those matters, especially the rise of nationalism, are not only products of the Reformation. Some of them are actually the products of Reformation theology, as we've seen. Now, another leap to another ball of wax. Roughly toward the end of the 18th century, we see the culmination both of new technological developments and new intellectual change, which we call largely the Enlightenment, in which ways of thinking about these matters get more dramatic and pushy, and the possibility of restraint is even weaker. That is, and you recognize these changes, but we don't often take note of the fact that each of them will have an impact on whether you can restrain war. The theory of the state changes. Until the 18th century, when you talked about government, you meant the royal house, the king and his family and his cousins, the dukes, and the way that network of elite people used the country for their own interests, claiming to be good rulers, and maybe sometimes being decent rulers, but in general, it was the royal house that fought wars. But now, democratic nationalism arises as a theory that the people ought to have their government, that the whole nation as a mass rises up in favor of good government instead of bad government, seizes the Bastille, or in some other way dramatically takes over the nation. So the nation is all of us instead of the ruling house. That means it's less likely that there'll be any leverage, any fulcrum from which there can be any restraint, any critique. And the more you claim that there's something righteous about democracy or something right about the voice of the people, then the closer you come to democracy, the less you can conceive that the enemies or people on another side have stakes that you ought to respect. So democracy is very open to demagoguery and to fascism. In the French Revolution, it went that way in the space of a couple of years. That is, once you have absolutized what you claim is at stake in a change of government and you put it in the hands of everybody, you put it in the hands of the people who manipulate everybody the most efficiently. And that can mean a very rapid loss of the stakes that you ought to think about in the just war tradition, that is, the people on the other side of the conflict are human beings with rights as well. Another thing that democratic ideology does is to make everybody a combatant. In the old days, knights would fight knights, and mercenaries would fight mercenaries, and most of the other people were supposed to stay out of the way and be left out of the way. And a true knight would not trample over the crops because the peasants are supposed to be left out of the war, and a clean-fighting mercenary would not pillage people unless a special dispensation was given at the very end of a war. So that most of the civilian population was not involved in a war, and that was natural because fighting was done by fighters, and they had people with a special slot in society. But now, with the notion of democracy, everybody is identified with the cause, and philosophically identified, and maybe emotionally identified, stirred up to be on the side of their country and against the other country. So there are less... there are fewer safeguards available to protect the idea that there are people on the other side of the battle line whom we shouldn't kill because they are not part of the battle. And then technology changes all that too. There are now, by the Napoleonic period, cannon which can shoot across the horizon. So you can not see whom you're hitting. By definition, you can't be discriminated. There is a speeding up of the potential for getting somewhere. An 18th century army to get from Paris to the Rhine would have to walk for a couple weeks. Now they have railroads. So you can mobilize much more rapidly. There's less cooling off time for the diplomats to do their work before it's too late to get into a war. So in many different respects, technology already by the time of Napoleon had made war indiscriminate and uncontrollable. And we use the term total to talk about what war has become by then, and the total means many different things. It means everybody may be the victim because the arms are indiscriminate. It may mean everybody is a combatant because of the philosophy of democracy, or everybody is a combatant because the whole economy is mobilized for war, and even if somebody stays home and makes ball bearings, that's an essential part of the war effort. Or somebody stays home and raises wheat, that's an essential part of the war effort, so you can claim everybody is an enemy. So the space to be non-combatant, the space to be out of the hostility gets smaller, and the causes are escalating because now we claim it's the freedom of the world that's at stake rather than this piece of turf that we want back from our neighboring country. One additional package of developments overlaps a little with what I said in the 16th century, and that is the notion of revolution. Thomas Aquinas said the most firmly, first, that in order to have a war be justified, it has to be waged by a legitimate authority. And in the Middle Ages, that meant very clearly, simply, somebody who was, in fact, the holder of the throne. And you know how that's legitimate because you have the rules of dynastic succession. He left the door open a crack, but only hypothetically, for the case where a ruler could be a bad ruler, tyrant in the bad sense, that is, someone who doesn't take account of the rights of his subjects. And if that should really be the case, then sedition against an evil ruler would not be the sin of sedition. It says in the New Testament that sedition is a sin. Thomas was very literal at that point. But you're not committing the sin of sedition if the king against whom you rise up is a bad king. Well, Thomas didn't explain at all how you know that a king is bad or how you know that rising up is going to make sense, and he didn't identify any revolutions that were good. But the concept was there.
Then that concept, of course, gets stronger in the 16th century, where I reported it, that it can be appropriate to kill a ruler who is repressing the true faith. And then in the 18th century, we have the Enlightenment vision of revelation fulfilled in the French Revolution, Revolution, where the people have the right to be their own rulers, and by definition, royalty is not an acceptable form of government, and revolution by definition is all right. This is a kind of just war tradition. That is, it asks about just causes. It doesn't say generally massacring everybody is all right. It says a change of regime is a good cause for which to have war. But it does make it harder to be clear how you're going to look at the other criteria that the just war tradition had asked about. If the ruler is not a just authority, who is the just authority who rides the right to wage a war? Well, if all of the populace were led by one revolutionary hero, well, then there'd be no problem. That's a just authority. But in most cases, we see that today in Palestine, and we see it today in Nicaragua, and we've seen it in most National Liberation Front settings. Usually where there is a revolutionary fermentation, there are several authorities claiming to be responsible to lead the revolution. None of them has all the people behind them. Most of them have a minority of people behind them. And in many cases, as in, for instance, the beginning of the Algerian Revolution, they kill more of each other than they do of the French. So how do you know who can fight a just revolution? That makes it harder to live up to the just war system. How can you know that it will probably be successful? Because you remember, that's one of the criteria of a justifiable war. And success in a revolution doesn't just mean success in taking power. It has to mean success in setting up a better government than the one you had before. Many governments are thrown down by people who replace them on the throne or at the trough, but are not able to run a better country. In fact, we're watching that right now in the Philippines. There was a nonviolent revolution which seized power 2 years ago, and it isn't very good at running the country. So you can't really claim that a revolution is better for the people unless you can promise not only likelihood in taking power, but the ability to run the country more justly and peaceably than it was being done before. So while the notion of a justified revolution fits in principle logically within the just war scheme, it's harder to justify because identifying who has the right to wage it and how you know they're going to be successful is harder to prove than in the case of a classic war between nations. So there's a certain tendency toward the holy war concept. For instance, in many third world settings, a particular body will claim that the reason that they are the right leaders of the national liberation movement is that they have the proper ideology. That is, that they relate properly to the questions of capitalism and socialism, or the questions of commercial exploitation, or some other overarching ideological commitment, not that they have the people behind them, or that they can run a better society. So that means that when you move from war between nations to war that's revolutionary, you tend to move towards a justification that gets ideological or holy. During this time, that is from the Reformation to the 19th century, where were the churches? The churches as institutions, the synods and the bishops, or intellectually the theologians and the moral theologians? There isn't much indication of church leadership during these periods in the shepherding and mediating role which medieval bishops had tried to exercise, except in very Catholic settings. That is the world that still stayed very much under the control of the papacy, as represented by the case of Argentina and Chile that I just mentioned. Bishops could do that then, since the Pope did determine in the early colonial period which part of the New World the Portuguese could go to and which kind of part of the New World the Spaniards would go to. And both parties accepted that. So there was a kind of distant shepherding concern on the part of the papacy, so that there wouldn't be continuing battles between Catholic nations. But there wasn't much of that anywhere else, and there wasn't much of that among Protestants. we don't find in the documents, although maybe some historian will find more, evidence that the criteria of the just war tradition, the ordinary questions of last resort, due process, legitimate authority, necessary modest means, treatment of civilians, all of those questions, were asked with any seriousness by spokespersons for the churches through the 18th and into the 19th century, against their own cause. Preachers would line up loyally to support their government in its wars against other nations, although until the revolutionary period, of course, those wars were small and dynastic. But one doesn't see the church standing back and saying to the embattled governments that it would be better to solve this problem some other way. There are philosophical speculators saying this kind of thing, and we'll look at some of them a little bit the next time toward the end of this period. But in general, the churches have given up. The Lutheran churches don't tell the Lutheran princes to fight cleanly, and the Calvinist princes are not given directions by the Calvinist churches. The theological intent of the just war tradition from Augustine to Luther was to argue, although we acquiesce in the fact that there will be war, we haven't abandoned all restraint. And we use these just war questions about how you fight and when you fight and last resort and only fighting in winnable causes to restrain the warlikeness which, regrettably, we can't call the nations away from. But from Luther on, that restraining impact is just not there. So the just war tradition is on the books. In fact, it's the generation of Luther that put it in the creeds, but it's a dead letter. We don't find churches looking for the facts so that in a particular case they could know, is this a matter of last resort? Is it clear what the cause is? Is it clear if territory has been occupied that it doesn't belong to the people who occupied it? That is, digging out the facts. We don't find churches trying to do that. Watching the skills of the diplomats, whether they've tried to solve a problem without warfare. All of the things that it would make sense to see the churches doing if their commitment to the just war tradition were profound and insightful and committed, they don't do. So, in fact, and it's not my judgment, it's that of the historians who are in favor of the just war position, that from the end of the 30 Years' War, that is about the age of Grotius, to the end of the last century, the just war tradition was on the books, but it was a dead letter. Nobody really guides their politics by that. The politicians don't, and the citizens don't, and the soldiers don't. Soldiers don't say how they're going to discipline themselves to respect non-combatant immunity or only to use weapons that are necessary in order to achieve their justified goals. And that's an interesting kind of contradiction in the shape of our culture. Most Christians, pacifists and non-pacifists, believe, and they say when they talk in circles like this, the majority position is the just war position. It's in the Augsburg Confession, meaning that therefore it's in the Book of Concord, therefore a Lutheran minister has signed that he agrees with it. In principle, it's there in the books. In practice, nobody has invested any costly effort, and not many people have spilled ink, on making it stick, on making these notions of restraint apply. So, in fact, what nations have been doing has been total war, not just war. It's been war without restraint, either in the mode of realism, you do whatever's in your interest, or in the mode of holy, you claim that your cause is so righteous that you have no obligation to the people on the other side. Now that's the history lesson. We can move already today, if you want, into the beginning of the next chapter, but first, I think it's appropriate that we look at the dismal side of the picture, that people have been saying, and on a superficial level been serious and sincere in saying, we don't believe that anything goes. We believe only in fighting for just causes and with just means. But as a matter of fact, that statement has never been seriously implemented by church people, by military people, by political people, until the beginning of the century, when some people started to ask about it again. Does that call for any kind of questions or spelling out?
It seems to me up to about the time of Napoleon, the church still had kind of one little ace in the whole, so to speak, and that was on Sundays. A lot of the armies didn't fight. It was a time to do laundry and kind of take care of wounds and that, but Napoleon changed that by attacking on Sundays, much to the dismay of not only the Catholic Church, but also the people that he was fighting. So much so that I understand several of the generals refused to fight. They thought it was unfair and they wanted to pull back and all this, but he brought in the whole concept of attacking on your holy day, which was also picked up, you know, by the Japanese in World War II, and then again in Yom Kippur in 1967, Egypt attacked Israel on their holy day.
Yeah. Well, that's a good specimen of it's kind of a vestige of the idea that there are sacred spaces or sacred times. And one culture still held to that, and the other culture can take advantage of not holding to it. So then the side that held to it doesn't hold to it any longer. And they don't. The first several times that somebody attacks Jews on the Sabbath, they'll take a loss, and the next time they'll be ready. So that is the ultimate conclusion of the secularization process that started already in the Middle Ages when Protestantism said no more holy spaces, no more holy days, that remained a little as a vestige. And as long as both sides respected it, it was feasible to respect it. And as soon as somebody sees an advantage, realistically, he can sweep away that one last little piece of restraint.
I'm starting to feel that we have no choice, that we either are pacifist or we are war people, because they always find some just cause, no matter whether it's any of those. It's just like you have an argument with a person, you always find some just cause to continue that argument. And I think the only way out is total pacifism.
Well, that'll be the discussion for the next time, but let's be free to open it now. My assignment as journalist or historian or ecumenical moderator of a discussion among several positions is to give the just war position the benefit of the doubt. It has a certain clear logic. It is not idealistic because it recognizes that there will be wars, and then it tries to be responsible by saying they must be restrained, and there are clear criteria which can be applied to the factual situation in order to carry on that war under those restraints, and it's only under those restraints that we shall do it. Now, is the observation that you make, is that a judgment against all possibilities, or is it just a pessimistic reading of many cases? And there, it's the person who, of course, is in favor of the mainline tradition who would say, well, the fact that some people claim to have a just cause when they don't, or claim to be fighting for a just cause but don't fight fairly, the fact that they break the rules doesn't mean that the rules aren't right. John Courtney Murray, who was a Jesuit, the leading Catholic moral theologian on matters of politics and government in the first half of the century. He wrote an article just after the Second World War in which he very strongly condemned nuclear deterrence and nuclear mass destruction as a Catholic just war thinker, and responded after saying, just war thought has been a dead letter for two centuries. We don't hold it against the Ten Commandments that they haven't been obeyed for two centuries. The validity of a moral system is not dependent on whether people respect it perfectly. It's still a valid moral system, and that's the argument that somebody would make. The fact that people may have been cynical or deceptive and claiming to be fighting just wars when in fact they were fighting crusades doesn't keep the system from having its merit. But we have to make it work instead of letting people just say their cause is just and not ask the right questions. So Murray said, for instance, we may not ever use an atomic weapon. We'd rather surrender than use an atomic weapon because that would be the dramatic case of our not respecting innocent life. So that's one of the things we'll have to carry with us all through the conversation. Does the fact that the just war language has been cheapened by people who use it and in fact fight without restraint, or in fact claim a sanctified cause so that their enemies have no status, does that refute the system? Or is it still possible to hold to the system, but then you'd have to hold to it more carefully? Or is anybody planning to propose a modification of the Augsburg Confession, Article 16?
But it seems to me you have to differentiate between those who hold that all life is sacred. Once you have that conviction, then how can any shedding of blood or taking of life be justifiable, no matter what criteria you follow? And the difference, it seems to me, between the Ten Commandments and the justifiable war criteria is that you're restraining people from killing other people. I mean, there's no second chances for those that you're at battle with.
Well, let me try to make the argument for the just war position in the face of that particular comment. There's in two stages. The Ten Commandments, if we see them in the context of the whole Mosaic story, did not exclude the taking of life by the authorities in the case of war or the death penalty. The actual verb used in the Ten Commandments, the linguists probably are right in saying that means don't commit murder. That is illegal, disorderly, unauthorized killing. But death penalty and war were still possible in ancient Israel, according to the rest of the laws around the Ten Commandments. So that to apply the Ten Commandments in such a way as to say that all life is sacred, we need to escalate it in gospel perspective. And that's a valid thing to do from the New Testament, just as Jesus moves from saying that adultery is forbidden to saying that adulterous thoughts are excluded. That escalating of the law in the gospel is a possible argument, but it's not what the Ten Commandments themselves, in their context, meant to the first hearers and readers. But many people would say they believe that all life is sacred, but in a complex social setting where somebody else is going to take more life, it may be our duty to take the life of the person who wants to take more life, or to take innocent life to save, and take guilty life to save innocent life, or to take few lives to save many lives. So the just war reasoning process would not let you say of it that it does not respect the sacredness of all life. They would say that in complex situations, the sacredness of all life can best be served by recognizing that some life has forfeited its right to that sacredness by threatening others.
So that it's okay to play God if in fact you're sure that the other people are guilty of, right?
In fact, that they would, the people who argue with some conviction for the just war position would say that your phrase is not just a caricature, that playing God is what we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. God, as sovereign, wants innocent life to be protected. And that means that one crazy person trying to kill 40 people has forfeited his sacredness. And it's proper that the authorities or the neighbors intervene. And all the rest of the just war system is, I guess we could say, just extrapolated, developed out of that, mm-hmm. that first way of saying it. Innocent life is more sacred than guilty life. That's not incredible. A lot of people think that way. We may still want to argue against them. Mm-hmm. But that's its reasoning. And it's the majority position since the 4th century. We have a responsibility for all of that innocent life that somebody is threatening. And sometimes it's direct. I use the symbol of actually a person threatening to kill a lot of people. But there is the wider fringe of other values that are at stake. That is, the freedom of a nation, or freedom of worship, those other values that are at stake that are not particularly one individual's sacred life, but they are sacred values. And someone threatens them, that person's sacredness has been forfeited.
Well, looking at that, if I seen a man going to kill a bunch of people, and I had the opportunity to stop that by killing him, I would be in error in not doing so.
That's the argument.
That's very hard for me to deal with. Although I think I would do that, given the situation.
Well, whatever happened to the idea of removing people from society that are a threat to innocent life? I mean, there is always that possibility.
Well, maybe you can if he's armed right now and rampaging through the Holden Hotel with a machine gun.
I mean, you can shoot him in the legs. I mean, you know, there's always, good heaven. It's the whole idea of whether you think you have the right to take
Well, I didn't project that what we would be doing here would be comparing these different positions against each other mm-hmm. as to which one is more Christian or more human or something. I do that argument a good bit of the time, but I'm seeking now just to understand each one in its own coherence, and especially this one, which is the majority view, the official Lutheran view, as to what it takes to make it credible and how its credibility has been rising and falling. There would be various additional elements to the debate if we really want to argue whose business is it to stop a raging maniac with a machine gun. But there would be also arguments about whether that is really a good parable, whether that is anything like what's going on when you have war as an institution. When you have advanced planning and training and financing and development of machinery, that's not the same thing as a spontaneous response to a maniac. It's an institution. And so the argument based on the maniac isn't really quite an adequate argument.
Do you see any remnants of the just war theory having operated in Vietnam? Recognizing that on one end of the spectrum, people said the reason we couldn't win it was because we had to be so restrained, and of course, recognize on the other sense that there was great war made upon the general population, sometimes seemingly without restraint. But I recognize, you know, we didn't drop a nuclear weapon on Hanoi. There were various things that operated. Do you see this as primarily politically motivated, where we couldn't get away with it, or do you see any remnants of the just war theory having been operative within the society's debate that, in a sense, put a kind of restraint upon what maybe some generals would have liked to have done had they not been restrained?
Yeah, some of those things will come tomorrow. The most evident memory of the notion of just war is the young men who wouldn't go. They were actually obviously making a just war statement, and I'll give that some more attention the next time. Or prosecuting Lieutenant Kelly for a massacre of innocent people. It didn't happen often. It didn't happen every time there was an atrocity, but at least it could happen when enough people knew about it. But the reason it happened was that it got back to the American public, not that the military machinery itself would have chased down all of the atrocities and punished them. But that you punish an atrocity is one case. And the notion of some restraint, and that, of course, was debated, as you allude to it, in the Pentagon
in that there were some of the generals who wanted to bomb the country back to the Stone Age, and others who said we must fight according to the rules. And some of the rules, some of them were able to respect, and others of them didn't get respected, especially with regard to free fire zones and what constitutes civilian status in a war where 12-year-old kids throw grenades at people. So it was very hard to ask the American forces to respect all the rules in a war that was so irregular in the way it was being fought by the other side, but there were people who wanted to respect some of the rules. So we do, it's a very delicate mix of elements of continuing respect for the just war restraints and overrunning numerous of the just war restraints at the same time, different places in the war.